Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey everyone, you're about to hear a very special episode, our 100th, recorded live with a studio audience last week. We had an amazing evening. I hope you do enjoy the hour or so ahead of you, as we thought we'd do something a bit different for our big anniversary. What I would say is that if you'd like to watch this week's episode in video form, you can, and I strongly encourage it. We filmed the whole thing in HD, multiple cameras, the whole shebang, to let you feel a little bit like you were there on the evening. And it's not often that I would say, hey, stop listening to this and listen to something else. But on this occasion, I think it is worth enjoying the video version if you'd like to, simply because we've never, ever done anything like this on video before with the show. Now, you can find it super easily because it's on YouTube now by going to live.techpodcast.uk. It's really easy. It'll redirect you to the YouTube page where you can stream it, or I've included some download links in the video's description there if you want to watch offline or keep a copy. So that's live.techpodcast.uk. There's a link on Twitter too, of course, at textmessagepod, or just go to just natelangson.com/podcast, or in the MP3 description of this week's episode right now in your podcatcher if you look there. So loads of ways to find it, live.techpodcast.uk. Really hope you'll enjoy that. Otherwise, of course, feel free to continue listening, as this audio version is exactly the same content, but without my massive grin and without Ian's massive hair. Now, on with the show.
Ian?
Yes?
Shall we begin?
Let's.
Okay, let us. Let's do it now. You're listening to episode 100 of Text Message with me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
And for the first time ever, with you, our live studio audience. It works. The microphones work. So far, it's working wonderfully. Ladies and gentlemen, we have an incredibly fun show lined up for you tonight. We did not want our milestone episode to go uncelebrated by as many guests as possible who could fit into a studio. And it is amazing that so many of you could join us this evening, including some of our beloved patrons. People so good that they not only support us financially each week, but also show up to reclaim their contributions in the form of our free beer. But welcome to you all. You guys are amazing.
It's not that expensive getting beer down Tesco's, is it, mate?
No, it's not. Anyway, Ian's already gone off script, so that's fine. We're not alone on this big stage, and we are privileged to be joined by some of the British tech and gaming industry's finest individuals available at short notice to help carry us through the next hour of British tech nostalgia, fun, and analysis. And it will be analytical. Let's meet them. To my right, ladies and gents, senior editor at Wired, Vicky Turk.
Hi.
And next to Vicky is, for 30-odd years, Nate's brother,
almost
Andy.
30.
Almost 30 years. And senior editor at CNET. And I know you're never going to quit CNET, but have you ever thought about quitting as being Nate's brother?
It's crossed my mind, but the pay is pretty good.
So. Yeah. And you get to appear here.
Yes. And to my left, host of gaming video series Outside Extra, Throw the Rest Away, it's Luke Westaway.
And last, but statistically most unlikely to be least, it's Katie Collins, who is a CNET correspondent as well and a Golden Retriever enthusiast.
That's me.
Now, we're taping tonight's landmark live show at Tech Hub. Big thanks to them for hosting us in this great venue at relatively short notice here on London's Ropemaker Street. Fun fact this, everybody, Ropemaker Street is in fact my second favourite street name in the whole of London. Does anyone want to hazard a guess at what my favourite street name is? Not the very rude one, Andy. No.
Knight Rider Street near St Paul's.
No, not that one. No, the correct answer is Poultry. Poultry is the answer.
Was anyone else expecting a good fact about rope making there?
Yeah,
as I was.
Have you got one?
I don't like to string people along.
Oh.
That wasn't even on the script. We've got a great show lined up tonight, everyone. We're going to cover some current trends and a lot of nostalgic trivia from the past, and we have a fantastic special guest to bring some real local perspective into how technology is shaping British schools and communities. Look forward to that in about half an hour. Now, we're going to start by looking back through modern history a bit with what is ostensibly a quiz. Now, our guests will need to buzz in with their answer, but although the show does make some money each week, we spent most of that this month on things like beer tonight to subdue the audience into not noticing the cracks in our production, such as not having proper buzzers for guests. Instead, our guests are encouraged to somewhat shout out. Is everybody happy? Should we begin this thing?
I can have my own buzzer sound if you'd like.
Yeah, we're good at it.
Do I have to buzz in then?
No. just two great examples.
Fingers on buzzers that don't exist, teams. It's question one. What British innovator did something interesting with balls in the 1970s? Andy?
That was a bad buzz.
He didn't buzz, ref.
That's fine.
Was it James Dyson?
It was James Dyson, yes. What did he do?
Well, he put the ball on the Hoover, but I'm not sure if it was that early, was it?
No, but you're close enough. He put a ball on a wheelbarrow.
Has the man gone mad?
In 1974, it was called the ball barrow. It was sort of like a...
Of course it was.
Does no one actually remember this? Like, this is... maybe it's because I'm old.
But I remember seeing this in B&Q. Yeah, yeah. Like, I've seen a ball barrow. I didn't know it was a 1970s... Yeah.
No.
They're great. You can...
No. In what way is a ball barrow superior to a wheelbarrow?
Well, if you tried them side by side, you'd know.
I will point this out. What James Dyson thought would be great about the ball barrow is that it would roll over certain surface areas with greater ease.
What year was this?
1974, very long time ago.
Before your time. So can we reasonably say that Dyson provably failed? Because that's not what that's not what real wheelbarrows look like now, is it?
That's all you want from these people. You want a failure.
All I will say is that he won an award for it in 1977. But I agree, it does feel like a bit of a departure from some of the Dyson inventions of today, doesn't it? Although, you're right, he did add a ball to various things, like the vacuum cleaner. He adds a lot of things.
If you've ever used that wheelbarrow, you'll know that it does tip over quite easily. That's probably why it doesn't exist anymore.
Mm. No, I feel the same about the vacuum cleaner. I lose control. It goes all over the place. Mm.
It's quite a good surname, though, isn't it? Ball Barrow. David Ball Barrow.
Would it be a double barrel surname?
Or ball? No, it's like
your Nate Ball Barrow or.
Double barrel.
God, we've got a quality audience, haven't we?
Give them enough time, and those balls will roll right out of the EU, won't they?
They will indeed. Well, yes, indeed. Where might balls be better used today, anybody?
Can I really say that out loud?
Yes.
Okay. No, I have a real suggestion, actually. Cars.
Right.
Because Goodyear have a concept for a spherical tyre, which it sounds insane. Like, how do you possibly attach a spherical tyre to a car? And the answer is really you don't. It uses maglev, so... Basically, your car will levitate on top of these four spherical wheels. The idea is that your car can move in all directions and it can move outwards and it has better traction.
Sounds bizarre, though, because maglev works okay on a train because they're on a track. But what happens when you're in a car? Like, it would just go all over the
place. Don't ask those questions, Kate. We don't need to think about what happens when it doesn't work in your car suddenly.
It'd be quite good for, like, motorway lane changes, though, you know?
Yeah, the idea is that...
Just, like, strafe.
Yeah, you will change lanes without you having your car having to change the direction it's travelling in. So it can be a lot safer, and if you push your car a bit too far and it spins, then the wheels can move in any direction they need to in order to bring your car under control.
That's the most amazing thing I've ever heard.
It's a long way off happening. Wow. No, it's not in the script. You asked.
No, I know. Okay.
It's a good answer, Andy, but you have gone wildly off script.
I do apologise. Yeah, we can cut that out.
Rate it in Hoyle.
Sorry.
It's fine. I mean, Dyson, aside from the stuff with the ball barrow, has invented a lot of things that either suck or blow. Vacuum cleaners. Careful. That wasn't even the deliberate joke. That's coming in a bit. Hair dryers, fans. I'm curious, what are some of the things Dyson hasn't invented but could? I've got one example, by the way. I have four, in fact. But I'm going to pick the first one, which is some sort of next-generation body drying system. So imagine you've just
like
had a
haystack dryer thing.
I am very unfamiliar with farming technology, but in my head, I've stepped out of a shower. I'm nude. I'm wet from the shower.
This is in all our minds now.
I don't know what
this has
got to do with
the
fall.
Go on.
Oh, no, wait.
And I want to get out of the bathroom. Wouldn't it be great to have some sort of drying system built into the arch around the door frame?
So that'd be like walking through one of the Airblade fans, really,
yes,
wouldn't it?
Except quieter.
Okay.
Would you have to walk through it really slowly over a period of about 30 seconds?
And step backward, back and forth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I thought about as far as this.
Put one leg in, one leg out.
Also, where
in,
does it blow
out,
the
in,
wet,
out?
The leftover water to? Is there a drainage system? You know, you've got to think this through. It's an architectural question,
there's
really.
There's a hand in the audience.
They actually have these at Centre Park.
What?
What?
That's what a haystack dryer is.
None of us are going on Good Enough Holidays.
Like Centre Parks.
Goodness gracious me.
Pound, but you get bronze.
Well, thanks for ruining that whole segment.
No.
I've used that one at Centre Parks, and it is like being breathed on by lots of giants.
Finally! My dream. Well, I was thinking, if you could apply the same tech to car washers, because I don't like car washers as they are now, like the automated ones, because you go in and there's big brushes come down and they slap your windscreen and makes you kind of look like you're driving through a crowd of pigeons or something and then everything's dying around you. So if you could go through a thing where it's just a blast of air,
a clean
the
blast.
Last stage of the car wash.
But the whole stage, it would only be that. You don't have the awful brush. Nonsense.
The conclusion here is that Dyson, there's nothing he hasn't invented.
No, that's right. He's invented all things.
I disagree. See, I think, you know, if you think of the power of those hand dryers, I'm thinking this could be the jetpack.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to returning to that on episode 900 when jetpacks make it to consumer availability. No, this is, of course, the fond memory that we have for the innovation spawned by British creator and surprising Brexit supporter Sir James Dyson. The mind boggles as to what innovation could be up his sleeve next that combines both balls and suction, but for the sake of decency, we'll assume it's something to do with robots or cars. Question two, fingers on virtual buzzers here. Let's move into the UK gaming history. Teams, a series of fantasy video games developed by British video game studio, or a video game studio, allowed the player to win the affection of the in-game public by demonstrating a number of bizarre skills, including whistling and making flatulent sounds. To whom and to what do we owe this innovation?
Luke's poised.
Oh, you got there first.
Siri has gone off on my desk. Carry on, Luke.
That was me, sorry.
Yes.
This sounds like Peter Molyneux.
Yes.
Of Lionhead fame.
Yes,
who is very much a kind of James Dyson analogue, I think. And not just because they both have tasteful grey hair.
Can you remember the name of the game series?
Fable.
Yes.
The Fable series.
It was indeed. Since you seem to be an expert on the topic, and indeed that's why I asked you here, can you remember any of the other skills you could deploy in the Fable games?
Yeah, you could get a dog to dig up things for you.
You could.
You could be a landlord. You could either be a good or an evil landlord.
I think that was
nice.
Fable 3.
Yeah, that's right.
Uh-huh.
What wonderful escapism games can bring.
Well, we're going to come to some weird simulator games. It includes the title Crane Simulator. On the back of the box, feel the thrill of the night shift. We'll come to that back in a bit, ladies and gents. Yes, the other things I have on my list here are loot playing, belching, victory arm pumps, and gift giving. That is a skill. And saving the world, of course. Quite the smorgasbord of options. Certainly, I don't think my fiancée, Kate, would have agreed to marry me were it not for my loot playing skills. Is that right? She says
yeah, true. Yeah.
Yes, we have a lot to thank Molyneux for. Can we think about what else Peter Molyneux is responsible for? He's done a lot in his storied history.
He did the cube thing.
The cube thing.
I remember playing it because it was the I'm trying to remember it. The idea was there was this giant cube and you could tap on your phone to get rid of some of the cubes, and whoever got rid of the last cube got some special prize, but no one knew what it was. And then it turned out that they got to be God.
Yes, Bitter Disappointment is the other name.
I was considering playing it, and I'm so glad, because I would have been so disappointed if I'd spent my time doing that.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Did they ever release the game?
Yeah.
The game where you were God?
Yeah, wasn't it Goddess?
Goddess, yeah.
And which is awful.
No. There was God, and then there was Curiosity. Something to do with a cube.
Okay.
Curiosity was the one with the cube.
Yeah, but yeah, Goddess, Curiosity was a cube.
Yeah, Curiosity was a cube, and then Goddess was the game where you were the god in, and it's a terrible game.
Yeah.
Do you know what's a really good game that Peter Molyneux developed? 1994?
Begins with theme hospital.
No, before
theme park.
Theme park. Oh.
Yes. I had this on PlayStation before. I had all the iterations of this on every single console or in every version you could possibly imagine.
There is a real quirk with that game on PlayStation, is that you could only load your previous save if you started the game with the same name on the registration screen.
Which
well,
I
hang on,
did.
That was nerdy. Let's forget I said that. But yes, theme park was amazing. We have some fun memories. Theme park, I mean, that was the one that a lot of people got into. That's a few years later. I don't think he developed it. I think he sort of came up with the concept for theme park.
He didn't come up with the concept of theme parks.
as a whole. Industrializing the creation within a virtual world.
Was it actually after Roller Coaster Tycoon or was it before?
Ooh. I think Tycoon was afterwards.
Right. Can we give a shout out though to Roller Coaster Tycoon?
Another great game.
Weakest shout out. Not as many Tycoon fans in as I.
But Molyneux was responsible for Theme Hospital as well. Though,
he
right?
was responsible for the concept, yes, and indeed I think probably some of the diseases that one could one could cure in Theme Hospital. My favourite was the bloaty head syndrome.
Yeah.
Any others?
Slack jaw.
Yes. No, well,
slack tongue. No, it's slack tongue. You had to go to the slack tongue clinic, and they'd roll it out in the yes. mangle. And
how do you explain? How do you explain to the doctor that you have slack tongue?
Oh, great doctor.
Terrible.
Text.
Well, surely it would be obvious.
Ruining my life.
I think for all fans of toilet humour like me, I think the squits was definitely.
Yes. There was also corrugated ankles, heaped piles, gut rot. I mean, a real joy. Of gaming, indeed. Makes me think, though, what other theme game could be created?
Theme podcast.
And that's what you're all playing tonight.
Wouldn't that be amazing?
Trapped in a simulation.
Theme podcast.
Of your creation.
Well, it's going quite well so far, so clearly it's very pleasant. We're getting to level two.
There was a very popular mobile game called Game Dev Story. I don't know if anyone played that, but some hands in the crowd. But that was basically theme content creation, wasn't
wow.
it? In the, it was a simulator where you set up a little indie game studio and made a game and it flopped and everyone was fired, and well, they were in mine.
That sounds like a really depressing outlook of the modern gaming industries.
Yeah, well, I mean, it didn't sugarcoat it.
Hard realism.
Yeah, exactly.
Fair enough.
So what happens if your company creates a really good game? Then who owns the rights to that game? Is it you, the in-game creator, or the creators of the game?
I imagine the creators of the game. They probably
that
set
is a
up
genius.
They probably set up the app to harvest IP.
Right.
Sweet IP.
Allegedly. I mean, I've always found that some of the greatest examples come from the simulator series of games. We did mention, of course,
Crane
Simulator earlier. There's another really fantastic one called Street Cleaning Simulator. This isn't a joke. I've seen a friend of mine play this for several hours. It's incredibly tedious, is all I will say, but mindlessly compelling.
There's a guy on YouTube that streams Euro Truck Simulator.
I played that the other day for about 3 hours.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah.
If you I was in VR. So good in VR.
In VR. It's a VR. Okay. Because you look down, I just wanted to look at some nice landscapes. And you can start in Manchester. So I started in a truck yard in Manchester, and I don't remember where I drove it to. I think I put in, I eventually want to go to Paris or somewhere, but that is a hell of a long drive in a big truck.
Are you mostly just in the tunnel
time.
On the ferry?
You're just on the motorway. Oh. Like, I don't want to play this anymore.
I don't want to talk about this anymore. It's boring to still listen to. No, I mean, there are some great... Boat Simulator, City Bus Simulator, that's a
Goat
great one.
Goat Simulator as well.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Not from the same series, but yes, very good. In the same category as Octodad.
Oh, yeah. Octodad is excellent.
I was playing that the other night with Kate.
Yeah, a real life simulator, isn't mm-hmm. it, where you simulate an octopus pretending to be a father.
Yes. Did someone mention Job Simulator, the VR thing from the creators of Rick and Morty?
That is spectacular fun. Mm. It's the best thing I've played in VR,
it's
quite
very
possibly.
Silly.
It's very, very
better
stupid.
Than the wall climbing thing.
Yes.
Oh. Well, that's good. None of those had Peter Molyneux's name next to them, but that was indeed very interesting. Generally speaking, this was, of course, an excuse for us to poke our noses into the products from British gaming kingpin Peter Molyneux and his eccentric twists on blending real-world experiences into his studio's virtual realities. I, as a point of reference, was once able to spend a wonderful evening having my pet dog dig up prophylactics, which Luke referenced, I think, earlier, then convincing someone else's wife to accompany me to my temporary trailer for a bit of romance after impressing impressing her by whistling and showing off a severed head I'd been carrying around. Thanks to Molyneux, I was also once able to do this in Fable 2. Now, moving on to round three. Fingers again on the non-existent buzzers. I'm very impressed with how you're dealing with the lack of forward planning on the buzzing part. This is better known as Things I Didn't Know 10 Days Ago. We take touchpads in our laptops somewhat for granted, but can anyone tell me where one of the first ever touchpads, little finger pointer things, where the first one to be embedded in a portable computer was found? This is back in 1989. My goodness, what a long time ago that was.
Was it British?
It's all British. It's the point of the podcast.
Oh, that's the point of the podcast. Here I thought it was just a vanity project.
You should know the answer.
The sort of thing that only a brother could say to a brother.
Yes. Do you remember when I asked you to be my best man later this year?
Offer still stands?
We'll see.
Was it Scion? I don't know what model, but I think it was a Scion.
It was a Scion.
Of course it's Scion, because Nate is obsessed with
he
Scion.
He is obsessed with a Scion.
Explain why.
In how many ways? In how many options?
Briefly.
Why am I impressed with that? Well, firstly, they were ahead of their time. They invented, basically, they popularized the palm top computer concept, which is what we take for granted. We pop this in our hands. It had an innovative folding hinge system, ergonomic keyboard. You could connect it to a dial-up modem and do business things across the internet. This was in the 90s. I had Scrabble. Will Head has a question. We'll come to that in a moment. It had Scrabble. You could put it in the side and
play. Yeah, that's
in
the thing I was going to point out. You traded, I think, half your drum set when you were 13 to buy Scrabble for your Scion 3MX from Dixon's, which you played constantly until you got a score over 300.
Sounds like a wise investment to
give
me.
Give me a two-letter word I can't tell you the meaning of. Don't do it, because it's not on the script.
I was going to say Series 7. Also,
Autoread
on the Series 3 before it even had GPS.
What?
This is groundbreaking, unscripted information.
You've made us all look like fools, Will. Yeah.
But this, I mean, the reason for the obsession is because Scion was so deeply innovated in the 90s. This, the touchpad thing, that was 1989. The product name that I was hoping we'd get is the MC400. How could you not remember that?
Sounds like a robot 89. DJ.
We have a Patreon on hand.
And battery life.
Oh, long battery life. Those things lasted for ages. My 3MX took two AA batteries and lasted for quite a long time, more than the Game Gear at the same period did. Thanks, Sega. MC400
Sick
ran...
Sick burn to Sega.
Are we just airing grievances?
Not real from that one.
Yes. The Scion MC400, it ran a multitasking operating system with a graphical user interface called Epoch. EPOC. It was around for a very long time. In my opinion, it really was one of the finest uses for a dot matrix display, aside from teletext and train timetable boards.
It's a close race, though.
Nate was a dynamic and interesting 13-year-old, you can tell, can't you?
Mm-hmm. Such good times growing up. Now, just to advance on this topic a little bit, can anyone tell me where the Epoch system ended up, or at least bits of it? Will Head knows all the answers, so we're not going to him again. I'll give you a... Ooh, close. I'll give you a clue.
Honk!
We've all started
something
talking.
With Nokia.
Yes, it went into Nokia phones.
Great. There you go, then. That's fine.
The Scion software group, the group that made this stuff, rebranded as Symbian. And so the Symbian operating systems made popular by Nokia and friends in the 1990s were a direct descendant of Britain's Scion software. Isn't that amazing?
That is amazing.
It is amazing.
Where are they today?
Well, question well asked.
What other memorable inventions have British innovators come up with over the years? Please, panel.
I've got one. The wind-up radio. It was created by Trevor Bayliss in the 1990s.
He was. Do you know what he appeared on that I didn't know?
I did. I do know because Ian sent me a hilarious video earlier today.
We should tell the audience. He appeared on...
The Big Breakfast. And you can all go and watch the video. I'm sure Ian will send you the link if
gladly.
You want to see it.
Yeah, it was quite funny. I mean, he actually once said he made very little money from this invention, the wind-up radio, in the 90s. He lives on an island with a very funny name. It's called Eel Pie Island. I didn't know that was a real place. I thought it was a joke, but it is real. But yeah, he was a presenter, sort of, on Channel 4's Big Breakfast. He would talk about gadgets and things in a shed.
In the video in question, he's wearing an orange leotard of some kind. And then Johnny Horn hits things with a cricket bat.
It was the 90s.
It was the 90s.
We were all in leotards of some
stripe. Have you ever thought about bringing that back, Luke? You're a presenter and a host these days on video.
I'd love to see you in a leotard.
I think I'm enough of a thought leader to bring back the leotard.
I think you should give it a go.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. If I do nothing else with
all
my
in favour, aye.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Surprise everyone. Well, these are all stage clothes. They all tear away.
Anybody else got a famous British innovator?
I can only think of the Sinclair C5.
Oh, the little car thing.
That's a very, very demeaning way of putting it.
That's coming back.
Oh, God.
No, one of Sinclair's relatives has come up with a concept.
I think it was his nephew.
Yes.
I saw it on the BBC.
The concept's already there. It was perfect to begin with.
The little electric thing, right?
Yeah, it was good.
Yeah.
Right?
Batteries have come on a long way. You could do it credibly now, I reckon. It'd be awesome.
Yeah.
But so we've got small, tiny, crappy electric cars that are basically the Sinclair C5 now, haven't we?
My kid
the
has
Renault
got a
Twizy is basically well,
that, yeah, but that's a bit fun. But the little electric Tesla that he's got is really good. And if it wouldn't
wait,
be,
wait.
You know what's
better?
It's powerful enough to drive an adult, I'm sure.
Little bit of an interruption here.
Yeah.
His little Tesla.
He's got a little Tesla. A lithium-ion powered.
You know what's even cooler than the kid's little Tesla? The full-size adult Tesla. Yes, really nice car.
It's a little bit. He does crash this one quite a lot. I wouldn't trust him with a full-size.
Maybe not.
Your son has
a 3.5. Yeah. It's this big.
Wow.
Does he ever let you have a go in it?
You're so new media, Ian.
No. That's incredible.
I'd crack that.
That's incredible. I mean, other answers that we could have had, obviously the web, Tim Berners-Lee in the 80s. I remember he once said that putting the double slash in http://... was a mistake. He thought it made URLs needlessly long. And I did want to say, I don't think removing one slash was going to make a difference.
Well, two slashes.
Well, yes. I mean, that's a 50% reduction, but it's still not going to change the...
I think we can all agree it goes Sinclair C5, internet, and then some other things.
Ball barrow.
The rest of human endeavour.
There was also the thermos, British invention, in 1892. Automatic kettles, thanks to Peter Hobbs. Electric, like, you know, you don't...
Oh, they tick off when they boil. They don't do the whole... They don't...
Did they used to just get hotter and hotter and hotter and hotter until your house caught fire?
Well, they used to boil all the water away.
Really?
Yeah. Well, if you put one on a hob, that's what happens, isn't it?
He called the first one the boil bag.
That's great. I'd just put water in a toaster.
They should put a ball on a kettle so that when it boils, it rolls off the side.
There was also cement, the lawnmower, the lava lamp. Didn't know that. Linoleum, not the No Effects song, but the stuff. The toothbrush and hip replacement. Mm. So we could have had those as options, but chose not to. That's fine. Yes, anyway, this is what's wonderful, what is indeed wonderful about diving into the history of British technological innovation is that you realise that predominantly we're exceptionally good at producing everything necessary for the over 60s to have a comfortable life. Warm tea, the wireless, hip replacements. Today we rely a little more on our American cousins to produce everything we need to get us through happily to pensionable age, all the while looking forward to embracing the best of British through our retirement.
It sounds like we're very good at creating incredible innovations that the Americans then run over the finish line in an extremely profitable way.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All the while replacing hips. Anyway, that is, I think, 2 points to Andy and Vicky.
Great.
And
wait, there are points?
Well, they're off of this bit.
I mean, there's literally nothing to take away.
It's okay, Lou. We can bring it back.
Yes, we will. But we'll return to a little bit more silliness later in the show. But it's time to do at least one thing that we normally include on the show each week and discuss a pressing issue that's happening now and not in 1990. In terms of local video and entertainment in the UK, what have we got? We've got Sky's Now TV. We've got subscription apps for ITV's back catalogue of programmes, the same for Channel 4. We've got the BFI player. For movies, maybe. And of course, the BBC iPlayer is a no-brainer. And on top of that, we've got our American offerings like Netflix, Amazon Prime Video, and they've got, in the US at least, Hulu as well. And Hulu has said, I think, They'd like to bring the service across the pond at some point. They're all commissioning their own exclusive programming. It's a lot of services to consider subscribing to, made more stressful by the fact that they keep their exclusives to themselves.
Yes, and I want to watch things on Netflix like Kimmy Schmidt, but I also want to watch things on Amazon like The Grand Tour. And so it's getting quite fatiguing now. I feel like I can't subscribe to all these services and have money left at the end of the month for beer. So it's starting to feel like a subscription to all these things is as expensive as a Sky or Virgin package.
It is, and the question is, of course, do we want this as our future for entertainment? Do we, as Brits perhaps, just thinking on our little island here, believe that it's better to have a wide selection of individual services we need to subscribe to versus relying on our local incumbents like Sky, Virgin and the BBC, who are increasingly threatened by the new kids on the block? I'm curious. Let's turn to Katie. How do you consume TV?
I've seen Katie consume TV. Just starts at the edges, nibble here, takes down the whole screen, sucks down an HDMI cable like spaghetti. Sorry.
Well, thank you for ruining my private habits, telling them to everyone. I think I'm fully a product of my generation in that...
Blame society.
I mean, that's just the first point. But the second point is that I subscribe to multiple different services. I subscribe to Netflix, I subscribe to Amazon and to Now TV. Mm-hmm. And the way that I look at it is that I pay... I guess between £15 and £20 a month for all of these different services.
So still a little bit less than a standard subscription to something,
isn't it? It definitely is. And I've subscribed to Virgin and Sky before when I've been, living in house shares and, as we millennials are destined to do forevermore. I genuinely think, it's about the price of a cinema ticket in London, and that's one film a month.
In London, it certainly could be.
Yeah. A cinema ticket is £25.
No, it's between £15 and £20.
What? If you're going to see a cutting-edge film
And it does depend. Like, if you see it in premium special 65 mil, then it gets expensive. And
that's also, about right, I think. £15, yeah. £20.
Yeah. I remember it was like £6.
Especially if you factor in a smack.
Yeah.
Quickly
mounts up.
I actually looked this up. Do you know what the price of the average cinema ticket in the UK is right now?
Go on.
Might surprise you.
£10.
No, £7.40.
Oh, it's even better.
Well,
£7.40 is the average price, apparently. But
yeah, but it's places like the North, it's cheaper. Bring the average down.
Also, you can still go to the cinema.
North,
well, yeah, exactly. You're from the North. Is it cheaper to go
you
to the cinema?
You can still go to the cinema in Peckham for a
Friday.
It is a lot cheaper.
Told you.
We have the answer. So let's just, before we're going to talk a little bit about cinema actually in a bit, and this is really good that came up. I'm just curious about whether this multitude of subscriptions that we now have to consider having, like, is this actually right? We have so much access. I mean, we could even factor in things like YouTube into this. Snapchat wants to create original programming. They're all sort of ad-supported packages, but it's actually an enormous amount that we have to consider as opposed to what we're used to, which is pay for Virgin. Pick, do you want some movies, do you want some sport? That's it. It's simple.
I was just going to say the thing that has persuaded me that it's a good idea is having one box that I can put in my living room that I can get all of these things through at once. And it's almost the medium through which it's all delivered to me, and I can just switch between the things that makes it really appealing to me.
You're essentially paying for convenience, really.
Yes.
I've seen your house, though. You don't have one box. You've got Apple TV, you've got Roku, you've got a Fire Stick, and you've got an Xbox One.
If it was up to me, though, I would only use Roku.
Yeah, but you can't, because you've got different services and different things.
No, I can't, because I've got a boyfriend.
But it is interesting, because some of these devices do also require the investment in individual pieces of technology. Whether that you don't need to buy an Apple TV to consume stuff through Apple's platforms, and if they start getting into more of this, then that will only get more significant. But you still have to have something Apple-y. You still have to have something from Sky, perhaps. You still have to have the Now TV. Like, it's a lot. And I wonder how sustainable that is. Do you want it?
I don't mind it. If you compare this situation where you're paying for a bunch of different subscriptions, and I pay for Netflix and Amazon and Now TV, and that's a lot of different things to pay for. But if you compare that to how the TV industry was like 10 years ago, where you basically just got what you were given, yeah. I think that the reason it's a double-edged sword. Yeah, we have to pay for more things. It's a bit of a hassle having to swap between boxes, but that's... what you get is loads more competition.
I think as well, like, good. The original content is a real seller for me. I was never really tempted by Sky because I just felt like you're paying for a bunch of rubbish that you don't actually want and maybe a couple of channels that you do want. But the quality of some of the series that are coming out from Netflix, for example, and Amazon as well,
they're just so great.
They genuinely rival, you know, the incumbents.
They do, and it means that you have to consider a subscription. And this is one of the real sea changes that we're seeing, is that in the past you could have your subscription and you'd buy things on, you know, I mean, DVDs or VHS or whatever, but a lot of these are sort of exclusively tied to streaming platforms, and they're exclusively tied to monthly subscription packages. So you can't download, as far as I'm aware, the Grand Tour from Amazon without having an Amazon Prime subscription.
And that's what the problem, because you do need to be able to, I think, having a package in Netflix or in all the services where you can just get the episodes that you want. You know, you could just subscribe to that show. So if you want to subscribe to Netflix and get Better Call Saul, one of their exclusives, then you can just subscribe to that show, and that's what you'll get. If you don't want to have the rest of it, and it'll be maybe a pound an episode or £1.50 or something.
But we used
to
have that.
But that's how it used to be, yeah. And I found that so annoying.
Yeah, going on iTunes.
I don't know. It's so expensive. I think the...
Much more, for example.
And I think the current services are just priced just perfectly, so it feels like you're not actually spending that much. You know, it's less than a week's worth of copies.
Well, it's less than Spotify. So immediately, like, you just think, well, I'm paying £10 a month for music. I'm paying less for Netflix. That, therefore, it must be a good deal.
So even if you're only watching one series, you've got that full series, and it costs a lot less than a box set used to.
Yeah. Show of hands for the audience, I'm really curious here. How many people still have a subscription to either, say, Sky or Virgin, in the sense of you're paying for a package of TV? That is way under half.
About...
That is about kids, someone says. And
you cannot survive without Disney Channel.
Sports.
Yeah, and sports is a good point.
It's another
sports.
One.
Don't underestimate what you're getting back in the time by not having the adverts. The Virgin and the Sky option is you pay for the subscription and you pay to watch their adverts.
This is true.
I feel that,
although they are getting better, they have cut out... If you watch a Sky series on Sky On Demand, they do cut the ads, so you don't get quite such a...
They show an ad for Sky when you're paying for Sky.
Yeah,
but that's better than, you know, like one advert or whatever.
The problem is, though, is that the time you've saved in not watching the adverts, you then waste on browsing through Netflix's whole catalogue trying to find something you want to watch. Like, I will spend longer than I would watch a movie for trying to find a movie and then eventually realise, oh, actually, it's midnight and I'm just going to go to bed.
I think it's quite interesting the model they went for, though, because you were talking about quality. They could have gone down that mass market TV network approach where they have 22 episodes of largely junk, but what they've done instead is gone from that more kind of half British model of 12 episodes of quite...
It's the BBC
stuff.
Model, and I think we should say BBC iPlayer, also great and free.
Yes. Until you go on holiday.
Now, when I went into writing this section, one of the things that I wanted to talk about is whether this had an effect on cinema, because we've never had, this was my premise, we've never had TVs so large that have been so relatively affordable. And so my expectation was that we would have seen something of a decline in cinema attendance as we have progressively moved to consuming so much more in our homes. What I found so fascinating is that the research showed me I was completely wrong. And actually, cinema attendance still remains basically unchanged, give or take a few, you know, million attendances per year, since about 2000. And I found two interesting statistics about British cinema before we end this segment.
And he's going to tell us them whether he wants us to, whether we want them to or not.
I am, yes.
Each more interesting than the last.
Because that's my job. In Britain in 1946, it's a very long time ago, does anybody know the number, or can anyone guess close enough, the total UK cinema admissions for that year?
Do you want the number you've got on the script? Or no, do you want a jokey? Or do you want a joke number that I'm going to make up? 11.
I'll tell you the answer, because this blew my mind. Genuinely, I saw this number and I was like, how? How is that possible? It's 1.6 billion people or individual tickets in 1946 were sold for cinemas, for cinema admissions in that year.
Nothing else to do.
In Britain.
Yeah. War's over. Before everyone had TV. Yeah.
Absolutely amazing. And they stayed at not quite that peak, but close to it for a long time. But in 1984, this was a fantastic year. What a year this was. I was hoping Andy would chime in, but it doesn't matter.
Oh, it was when you were born.
Yeah. It's irrelevant. But yeah. Do you know what the admission figure that year was?
I do, because it's written down here.
11?
If I had to guess, I'd say probably somewhere in the area of 54 million or so. I didn't
know. 54 million. So it went from...
That is exactly right.
Yes, it is indeed. You're not getting a point for that, because that's called cheating. 1946, it was 1.64 billion admissions in a year. And in 1984, in the same country, 54 million.
That can't have been the highest number, though, in the 40s, though, was it?
That was the highest number in the 40s, yeah.
Really?
Yep.
When did Men in Black come out? That was surely the highest.
What?
It was pretty low. It's pretty low. I mean, today...
So that has to have been when everyone went to the cinema many times.
Men in Black.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Last year...
The world's greatest film.
No, it's Jurassic Park.
I heard... No, it's not. It's clearly wrong, but...
It's possible that And I'm not saying, Andy, because I know it upsets you and you might start throwing things, that Men in Black... I'm not saying it's not the greatest film
ever. That's good. I'm glad you're not saying that.
I'm only saying that it might be that critics at the time didn't realise how momentous.
And they might not realise for maybe another 50 years
or ever. But you shouldn't let that bother you.
As long as we realise it now, that is fine. That is okay. Because I wanted to point out one last number, which is the number for last year, 168 million. And that underscores the point is that cinema has grown. It is staying really stable, despite all of this innovation that's going on in our homes with massive TVs and an unparalleled access, as far as history is concerned, to blockbuster titles readily available at the touch of a button.
I'm not surprised by that at all, because there's a couple of sides to this. Like, the tech in our living room is never been better for watching movies. That's definitely true. But those movies aren't there to be seen. It's all like studio control over movie release dates. Years ago, we were talking about, oh, eventually we'll get to a point where something comes out in the cinema and the same day it'll be available in your home. And that just hasn't happened.
No.
You know, and that's the reason I think why cinema attendance is so high, as well as the fact that generally I think we'd agree that now, like the last sort of 5 years or so, have been a really good time for TV and movies. Like, there are so many good ones. It's pretty
great.
It's
almost like they're good separately, and you feel like a movie would be better appreciated in the cinema.
I do,
and there's so much good stuff at home on TV, you don't need to watch films maybe quite
exactly.
so much.
They are so separate in my mind. Yeah. I don't watch very many movies at home.
But cinemas are awful places to be.
Well, that is a conversation for another day. We'll leave that hanging there. And personally, I think it would be better if we could just get rid of the artificial geographical restrictions, such as our current inability to legally stream The Handmaid's Tale in the UK simply because of the soil we sit on. Not for any financial or practical reason, but because of backwards facing licensing deals that hold the industry back. But hopefully, at least over the next few years, we can see a little bit of a change there. Now, we are going to move into another segment, an interview. This is going to be a real treat for everybody, I think. We do have to ask our wonderful panel here to just depart the stage for a few minutes if they don't mind.
Interludal music.
Yes.
Oh, right. Right, okay, thanks, Nate. One of the things that struck me about having a child who's coming up for 7 is the way she's using Minecraft to build things. She's taken to it like a duck takes to water. So I suppose I shouldn't be surprised that kids are good with that sort of thing. I remember when I was a kid how I used to like building things in the computer, you know, doing little bits of coding. And we're starting to see Microsoft is encouraging it with its educational package for Minecraft. And, you know, there's a lot of amazing stuff. So with that in mind, we have a special guest.
We do, because it is such a great topic. So we want to spend a few minutes looking at how global efforts are benefiting local causes outside of this metropolitan London and other large cities, specifically how Minecraft is benefiting schools in Wales. So, ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the show a very special guest here for the evening from Ferndale, South Wales. You're going to love him. Assistant head teacher of Darren Park Primary School, James Prothrow. So now, as assistant head teacher, an important part of your role, I believe, involves leading literacy and digital learning at Darren Park Primary School. You've led a number of collaborative projects using Minecraft Education Edition and worked with teachers from across Wales to support the implementation of the Welsh Government's digital competence framework. So I'm really curious, we can just jump right into the deep end. Can you describe some of the Minecraft projects that you and the kids have been working on and sort of how they work? Maybe we can start with that great mine project you told me about.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, I suppose it all started, our Minecraft journey all started with a project that was very, very sort of personal to the locality of the school. So our school is in the Rhondda Valley, which was very famous for its coal industry, around 100 years ago. So what we did was we developed a scheme, really, a project where we worked with 16 schools from across the valley to create the Rhondda Heritage Park, which was a local mining museum that was dedicated to the history of coal society. And as I say, Minecraft, part of it, where we all developed a working coal mine, was really important. But probably more important was that was the actual understanding of what it was like to live in Ferndale, in the Rhondda, during that time.
So it was part of like a term sort of course, and the kids were making a working mine within Minecraft as part of their education.
That's right, yeah. So they visited the Rhondda Heritage Park. They did, in terms of the historical inquiry that they would normally, those skills they would normally develop within a history project. But with this project, we very firmly based it around the collaboration between the different schools within the valley, and actually got each school to focus on a specific area of the coal face, whether it was above ground or below ground. And what was brilliant about it actually was within the valley, the Rhondda Heritage Park, which is a museum dedicated to the history of mining, is central to everyone. So it's something we all walk past, something we all travel past. So it was a really good sort of leveler in that sort of sense.
And the schools were collaborating together to produce this?
Yeah, they created a different part. We held a big sharing event where they actually discussed each part, and I think for me, still what gets me today is when I show them the recording of what they developed, the fact they can talk so richly about the experiences that they had during the project, but also about the history that they learned during that time
and
as well.
Do you think it really helps kids get a handle on what, you know, the heritage of the area and how they, you know, what it would have been like to live in that time and do that job?
Definitely, and I think what the pupils did at the end, after they'd built it, they created a multimedia presentation where they actually voiced over the different bits, and I was astonished how much they actually remembered the topic, because there's always, at the end of a topic, you think, well, what have they learned? And I think from this, the video that they produced actually shows what they've learned, and, you know, and actually, as I say, talking to them today about what they've learned, it illustrates that.
And it's interesting because you instinctively think that maybe this is something for much older kids, but we're talking primary school age, right? It's like, yep, 5 to 11 years old.
Yeah, definitely. We use Minecraft from, well, our year one pupils to our year six pupils, so sort of from around 5 to 11. But it's always within the context of a rich learning experience. It really accompanies good teaching and learning and transforms a theme or an activity. And the children are using Minecraft anyway, so to get to that level as a hook is amazing, really.
Yeah. And tell me about the Roald Dahl project that you did. That's I saw that on one of your, I think, your blog, possibly, before today.
Oh, great. I'm glad you saw that. That was this time last year, schools from, particularly from Wales, were celebrating Roald Dahl's 100th birthday. And I thought, well, what would be really cool, I suppose, was for them to create the world of Roald Dahl, but then obviously the context still had to be the learning and what they'd get out of it. So I thought, well, what about trying to fuse developing literacy skills within a Minecraft context? So we developed a 3-week literacy unit where pupils developed, focusing on the settings, the really rich settings from Roald Dahl's books. And I thought, okay, we'll do this as a school and we'll put that out there to see how many other schools want to join us. So 92 schools from across the world ended up taking part in the project. We looked at, so if I talk personally from my classroom, we looked at the text like we normally would. And I said at the end of the lesson, okay, so I want you to show me your understanding of the text through building that setting during Minecraft, which took them very little time, at all. As a teacher, I've really quickly understood I don't have to teach them how to build in Minecraft. They'd look at me as if I'm stupid, I think, if I did try and do that. So we did that, and then I thought, well, we can't leave it there. because the reading skills are really important, but how are they going to develop into their writing skills? So we looked at using Roald Dahl themed narratives where they developed their own settings, created those during within Minecraft Education Edition. So for example, James and the Giant Peach, a really famous text, one of the children decided that she would create a text about a girl who created a picture, and every time she used a paintbrush, it got larger. So she created this in Minecraft, and I will say that particular pupil, that was the best narrative that she wrote. And as well as their writing skills, the fact they can talk about and explain, walk through the worlds, their oracy skills have really developed as well.
Amazing.
Did you find that with their what they were interpreting from the text was very similar to each other, or did they all take away something completely different imagination-wise?
Initially, I thought, oh, it is going to be very similar. But actually, when they were recreating the text, yes. But when I said to them, okay, now you're going to use this to create your own stories, it amazed me. You know, there was another child who created this house with trees all around the garden, and hidden within the garden, there was a football pitch. And, you know, again, the writing that came from it afterwards. And I think it was really important from the very beginning that this was a literacy-based project. So reading, writing, and oracy were going to be the main skills they develop. But I found that Minecraft really unlocked the doors and got their inspiration and gave them something to write about, actually, and, you know, really worked well.
Yeah. And what about the last one that I wanted to pick out here is something you mentioned to me called the Digital Leader Minecraft Roadshow.
That was an idea that the pupils decided, because they found that teachers, not pupils, teachers in schools were a little bit frightened of Minecraft, possibly, so they decided to go out and train teachers in other schools as part of their as part of the work they were doing, which astonished me. So we just put it out there. The first project we did, we offered the Minecraft Roadshow. The pupils will say it was a freebie to begin with. Now they've developed the idea where they develop different projects, and in terms of developing pupil leadership has been massive. So they develop the projects, they go out, and the last meeting they had with the head teacher really made me smile, because the conversation started with, so for an hour we charge £15, is that okay? But if you'd like us for the whole day, which is probably more beneficial, it would be £50, but you must pay your own transport. And, you know, I think getting children to realise these skills linked to Minecraft, getting them out into, you know, the pupils we've got in our school. I went to that school myself, and I know, you know, sometimes they don't see what goes on in the wider world. So for me, it's really important to set into that context.
Yeah. And do you think, like, I can only speak from the perspective of having a daughter that age, do you think that it's helping to get girls into science, technology, education, and, you know, engineering and stuff like that? Or is it just something that goes across both genders? And
I think that's the really unique thing about Minecraft, is it is definitely a leveller. That, you know, the majority of our pupils use it at home, and the ones that don't can see the context within school. And I think now the really brilliant thing, actually, is the fact that Minecraft Education Edition have brought the code builder element to it. So the pupils are able to develop the coding skills and embed them within Minecraft and see what they can create. And it really opens up another whole new element to the whole process, really.
Have you seen it improve any of the other skills? I mean, have you seen in this year an improvement in something that tangibly could be connected?
Definitely. In terms of oracy, our year six pupils who are leaving us now, I think we've had the highest number of level fives for oracy. And the children are far more confident. It does give me goosebumps when people come in and speak to the children and they say how incredibly articulate they are. And I think it's because they've had the opportunity that Minecraft has. And the reason they're able to do that is, as I said earlier, Minecraft is a leveller. When they go in and work with other pupils using Minecraft, you know, their job is done. What they create afterwards is, you know, is great. And a real hook, I would say, to get them into the learning.
And before we wrap up here, I was curious for, you know, for anyone with children listening, you know, what's the best way to, you know, maybe to inspire them to want to study computer science? And is Minecraft is it a good catalyst for, you know, building that intrigue?
Definitely. I'd say, first thing I'd say, and the thing that I've had from my students is, my parents don't talk to me about it. So I think talking to your children is a really important thing. And I would also say talking to the schools as well about it, because I think it's a really important thing that, as I say, we did it as a trial project initially. We've never really looked back, and you know, we invite our parents in to see the children's work. I think that's really important. But then we really actively encourage our pupils to go home and speak to their parents about the type of things and, you know, the wow that it can sort of bring to parents. But I'd say talk to your children about what they're doing, and definitely talk to their school to see if there's any way that, you know, they could be using Minecraft within the curriculum.
Well, this has been a fascinating and insightful conversation. Ladies and gentlemen, please look him up online. Reach out to him with Minecraft education queries. You will not be let down, as I'm sure this evening has proved. And give a big round of applause and thanks to him for journeying here all the way from Darren Park Primary School in Wales. James Prothero. Now, we are in the final stages, ladies
throws,
and gents.
If you will.
Sorry?
Throws.
Oh, yes,
it implies an ailing body of some kind.
Along those lines, yes. But we have a couple of sections left, and this is... we're going to start with a fun one. Now, during the writing of this episode, I titled this particular section, Improve the Thing. I see no reason, now we're on stage, and the title is still on the script, to change that.
Does right. anyone have any objections?
So, yes, quite right. So we're going to see how technology could be used to improve the following not-at-all tech things.
Indeed, yeah. We're going to start with one that I know Luke and I have a shared pet peeve with, the umbrella. They're awful. They've remained pretty much uninnovated since their invention knocking on 2,000 years ago, in my opinion. Might be a bit of an exaggeration there, but Luke... Since we are kindred spirits on this topic, what's wrong, do you think, with umbrellas?
Well, the first mistake you made there, Nate, was describing the umbrella as an innovation in the first place. It's not that it hasn't been innovated upon, it's that it was always a bad idea. And
But it keeps my hair erect. How could it be a bad thing?
Ian, no one knows what keeps your hair erect.
It's one of two things.
The problem I have with umbrellas is a very simple one, is that when you use one, I tend to get more rain on me than when I don't use one, because it doesn't shield you from the rain.
How are you holding it?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you're maybe...
I hold it the way it says on the label, but it focuses a normally harmless amount of sort of nice British rain mist into these concentrated rivulets of water that kind of fan out from the top and pour all down you. And, like, yeah, it might keep some off your sort of hair and shoulders, and Ian, I appreciate it
as
much as
you. How big is your umbrella? Is it like that big or something?
Right, okay, so size...
Here we go.
Size is another factor. Okay, so not only are your shoes getting all wet, basically, whenever you use an umbrella, because it's just pouring water down onto your shoes and you're splashing them, and those shoes are the worst thing to get wet.
Yep, true.
So I would rather I'd rather be slightly damp all over than have water in my shoes, and I think everyone here would agree with me 100%, and I'm not going to check, I'm so sure.
And it works the other way, right, as well, because if you have a massive umbrella, then you're that guy on the footpath.
Right!
Everyone's trying to get past, and, you know...
Umbrellas are fundamentally so rude. If you have a big one, then yes, you're more protected. But I would also ask you to consider how, when you're carrying a large umbrella, that's just a massive thing that you have
also,
all day.
If you have
a wet thing.
If you have a huge umbrella, you have to hold it with two hands.
Yes.
Because and that means that you've got no hands free to do anything else. So, you know, in this modern day and age where we like to be walking along with our phone in one hand and umbrella maybe in the other, then you can't do that.
Well, this is an unplanned tangent then that's wonderfully well placed, because I did see one small bit that I would categorise under brolivation, for want of a better portmanteau, which is it was sort of an umbrella that had an iPhone stand connected to the handle. Yeah. So you could hold up the brolly, and as you were shielding yourself from the British weather, you could be watching something on your phone.
Just do what a normal person does and not use the umbrella at all, and use your phone, and then when the screen gets too wet to use, go like this. It's on your wet clothes.
So let me ask this then. Before we move on to another example here, how could tech improve the umbrella? Because that is what we want to solve tonight.
We talked about James Dyson with his jets of air. Surely I can just see a stick, and it's just got air jets that just go.
I swear I saw someone do that. Yeah, someone's tried that.
It didn't take my great ideas. I am so, like
point from the audience. I want to hear it.
They're all being done.
Point in the audience.
And drone umbrella, yeah?
Drone umbrella.
Both hands free. It's perfect.
Yes. Now, this, we have solved it, ladies and gentlemen. We have solved item one here. The way to fix umbrellas is for James Dyson to invent a drone umbrella.
Except instead of getting people's umbrella ends in your eye, people are going to be having like drones dive at their head.
Fine by me.
What about a vast network of... So you don't have like one personal drone that's like a few feet above your head blocking the rain. What if there were thousands of drones forming a sort of nexus cobweb over all of London?
You mean like no rain could get through. You know the roof they put over Wimbledon?
Yeah,
you could have one the size of the country.
Drone style.
And on a rainy day.
That won't destroy farming.
No.
Or the world.
Well, look. If water falls on London, it's, I assume, just a waste. If we could get the drones to focus that into the concentrated rivulets that I was mentioning earlier. You remember the concentrated rivulets, or CRs for short, if you prefer. It could focus them into farms and rivers growing economies.
Farming needs you, Luke Westerweather.
Well, that was. Wonderful. You used the word waste, which is appropriate because we are a wasteful society. Tech is helping enormously, I think, and largely as tech companies get better at making recyclable products and have programs for recycling such products. But I also know, because he told me the other night when I was at his house, that Andy has a particular fascination with how the web and apps are specifically assisting with waste management. Andy?
Yeah, no, I do. There's a service I found. It's part of like the FreeCycle community, because we've already got the website freecycle.org, I guess. And where you can... And that wasn't derogatory. That's just, I think, is what it is. There's a service called Olio. It's an app, and it allows you to go on and list... like products that you have you want to give away for free. So obviously it's, you know, you've got like a bed or a mattress or a bookcase or something.
Well, I know you have much better examples.
Well, exactly. But I sort of had a look and I did find, I'm just going to have a look
live demo
screenshots. Screenshots, where are screenshots?
Well, I'll find screenshots. This is not the first example of such a service as far as I'm aware, but it is one of the most intriguing because of the sort of, well, the very specific nature of what people try to give away.
Some of the things that I found, for example, dog nappies, opened but not used, which is good to know.
So like someone opened them and was like, not for my dog.
Yeah, not for my, he deserves the best. Latterly then, adult nappies can be used for dogs to wee on if your dog lives in a flat. This one just says, Pin. Mystery cable. And on closer inspection on the photo, ooh, it is a scar sleeve.
Yeah. So,
someone was born after
millennials.
After 1990s.
I've never felt so old in my life as when I saw that. It's unbelievable.
And me.
A cable that was
fresh toast. Not French. Fresh toast.
How
rescued
fresh can
from
it
a
be?
Cafe in Stoke Newington. Well, this was listed about 3 weeks ago. It's probably not all that fresh right
no.
now. Better off making your own toast, I reckon. Teeth sculpture. Badge, brackets, clear. Two ripe and ready avocados, but the picture has three. So I would question where the extra ones...
But don't they often have them, you know, three shown, I've eaten one, or something
didn't
like that.
Didn't say... best before 3rd of May. What are we on now?
They're way past
that. Yeah.
Can you go around and squeeze them?
Hope to find them a new home soon. I have a suggestion.
It's the avocado equivalent of going around and kicking the tires of a car.
Yeah, yeah.
Squeeze it now, don't worry.
Sandwich, brackets, salmon and cucumber. So that's fine. Used brass door number 3. Could do with a cleanup. Courgette. Single courgette. Use ASAP. And then 22 empty cans. This one, finally, Mango chutney, used one dollop. That was it. Photo forthcoming, and so instead they just put a photo of their thumbs up.
This is the way the web is helping us.
I've got to say,
is it though?
If you've ever been on Facebook and have gone to the marketplace there, there's some quality stuff.
Was that like the same thing? Like a free cycle?
It's not quite as. It's not quite specifically sort of food-based as that.
Yeah.
There are some weird things.
I don't want to
things.
Say bad, because I think what Olio is doing and what the Freecycle stuff is doing is a really, really great service. I think the waste that we have, you know, it's obviously far too much. We know that. And any service like that that connects local people to, well, you know, I happen to need a new bookcase and this person's giving one away, great, that's fantastic. It's just the specific items that some of these people, in particular like the fresh produce, that really, if you don't get it within the half hour... It's not going to be very nice.
The thing that's bizarre about it, though, is the fact that you have to go onto the app and manually list, like, well, I've got this courgette hanging around.
Yeah.
What am I going to do with that? And, like, I imagine it takes about as long as putting something on eBay, which is ages and ages. But imagine if your fridge could automatically, like, inventory what you've got and then be like, FYI, I'm Andy's fridge and he's got some courgettes going. It doesn't have to do it that seductively.
But it would be good if it did.
It would be good if it did, yeah. And it would be nice if it was automated, then that could be a really useful thing. And then
but
my,
you'd come
my
home
fridge,
from work and all your food would be gone.
We're thinking, oh, he's not going to eat that. Trust the fridge. Yeah. No, it wouldn't, but it would be. It would,
and he's got some prime rib beef.
Some of it.
He bought it on Sunday. Can't have been
fridge,
saving it for a special occasion.
Some of it would be gone, but I'd have extra food there because my fridge would be talking to the other fridge, and Andy's fridge would be like, Andy's got courgettes going, and mine would be like, interesting, Luke hasn't eaten all his beans. And so they would. They would dispatch drones from the ice tray.
Are those the same drones
I'm not sure
holding
I like
the umbrellas?
This
oh, it'd have to be.
I think if you automated it, it would be good, is the point I'm trying to make. Very, very.
Hands off my courgettes, Westaway.
We have to stop because I'm laughing too much.
And we run out of time.
And we run out of time for that particular section. Goodness me. I wasn't expecting all of that, but thank you. That is me. We have definitely come up with the ways to improve those things that we just discussed.
Did we, or did I just make fun of a well-meaning service?
Somebody will be listening to this. Enough people listen to the show for somebody to say, having that.
We'll get an email.
I hope so.
We'll get an email. Someone will have taken that chutney by next week.
Yeah. Well, let's keep our
minus,
eye on that.
Please don't let me down. $1
PM. Now, before we wrap up and have our closing final thoughts, one thing I wanted to do at the end of the show is just celebrate some of the bad product names over the years that we have seen, largely because they amuse me and it's a good way to finish a show. Has anyone got an incredibly bad tech product name that they'd like to share?
Oh, I have one.
Katie.
So this is funny. You'll see why. you'll hear why. It's a product called the iMuffs, which...
I wish I wasn't the first one to laugh at that.
iMuffs. Probably not for the eyes.
Well, they're not for the eyes, which is very strange considering they're called iMuffs. I mean, we've got earmuffs. You would think the iMuffs would do the same, but for your peepers, but apparently they do not.
You'd crash into something, wouldn't you?
But just headphones.
What are they?
But just headphones.
Oh, right.
Standard headphones.
Yeah, standard headphones. Yeah.
But why have they got an eye in them? Is it an eye?
Oh, because everybody...
It was that age where, first of all, everything was E. E-cafe, right, yeah. E, and then it was I.
E-mailer. Oh, no, that's...
And then Apple started suing people, so they had to start with the I.
Right.
A favourite of mine is the DigiScent Eye Smell, which apparently was a personal scent synthesizer. There was a prototype that connected to PCs via USB and was designed to emit a smell when a user visited a website or opened an email.
What?
Which websites?
Well, exactly. What would CNET smell of, one wonders?
Lavender.
Roses and happiness.
What do you imagine Facebook would smell of?
Just disappointment and
sadness.
Just like the smell of someone who hasn't showered for a while,
a
but
hospital.
Followed you for a long time down the street.
Instagram would smell of everyone else's food.
I've got to put a bad name vote in for the Sound George.
Oh, the Chestnut Hill.
The Chestnut Hill Sound George.
iPod dock, I believe.
It was an iPod dock, but the Sound George, of all the names...
George, like the name.
Like George.
Like Curious George, but Sound George.
No, George.
No,
that would be Gorge, with a hard G. No, a George, as in the Sound George. You know, the man you really want taking care of your audio. George. Just George, the sound George.
I really like the Chestnut Hill sound George because it, a lot of technology has a lot of X's and like I's and serial numbery sort of names that are very hard to keep track of. But Chestnut Hill sound George sounds like a place and a person. And I just think that's nice. It'd be good if the new iPhone was like the Holland Park Jennifer.
Well, since you had such an insightful comment, do you have a favourite bad game name from the throes of history? Pick one.
Well, we were talking about, what was the one we were talking about Peter Molyneux making, the one that was actually the name Goddess?
Oh, Goddess, yeah.
I thought that was pretty weak.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything with an acronym.
Yeah.
There's one of my favourites was Golf Magazine presents 36 Great Holes starring Fred Couples.
Golf Holes. Yeah.
I assume so, yeah.
Assume what you like.
It's a strong assumption to make, and I shouldn't, but...
There was also the incredibly unfortunate Touch Dick, D-I-C... which was a touch-enabled dictionary for the Nintendo DS.
I mean,
for
the DS? Not only a bad name,
that's
but an actually terrible idea.
Yeah.
Yes, it is. What do you need a touch dictionary for?
Because it was a touchscreen. The DS had a touchscreen.
I understand
so
the concept,
touch
but
dictionary.
Yeah, but why do you need?
Yeah,
they didn't put that on the box.
Touch dick brackets dictionary.
I mean, I guess that was a product of its Japanese heritage.
I believe I may be wrong. I actually believe it might have been South Korean, but I think it was certainly.
So it was a translation issue.
Yeah, a bit lost in translation there.
A little bit. The other one lost in translation, just before we wrap up. This was a Japanese game, but it was released over here. Tactics Ogre, Let Us Cling Together.
I think that's sweet.
It is rather sweet, isn't
Most
it?
Most video games are about the end of the world in some form, and what else can you do but cling together?
It was a fairly violent game, but the title inspired a hug. Which is rather beautiful, and it's a lovely note for us to end on.
And do let Luke Westaway know if you'd like an embrace of some kind.
Yeah, I'll embrace literally anyone or anything. That's the Westaway promise.
I've seen it. I've seen it done.
There's a rather intimidating bear behind us. It's got its arms out ready. I think he's ready for you, Luke.
Would you say he's trying
crying
to,
out to you?
He will bear arms. Sorry, let's finish. If I go off script, bad things happen.
This gives me pause.
That joke was...
that was grisly.
Quickly, end.
That joke was grisly.
That is going to be a wrap for this special 100th episode of Text Message. We have truly learned a lot together this evening, together. I said that twice. From ball barrows to the future of the umbrella. From Fable's lasting teachings about social etiquette to the road ahead for British media consumption. We've also been reminded that some of tomorrow's most inspiring entrepreneurs and tech enthusiasts are currently developing their skills not in central London universities, but in small Welsh primary schools. While Britain may not be at the forefront of every high-tech endeavour read about in the papers, our contribution has been consistent and memorable enough to form the basis of an hour-long nostalgic journey through its flavours and forms. And we have no shortage of contributors to thank for that today, and hopefully tomorrow and beyond. I want to thank our guests for helping make tonight possible. Please give a huge hand, or indeed several hands, to Vicky Turk, Andy Hoyle, Luke Westaway, Katie Collins, and from Darren Park Primary School, James Cutlow. And thank you, of course, to Tech Hub for hosting us here on the delightful Ropemaker Street. Who knows, maybe we'll get to host episode 200 somewhere along poultry. That would be great. But most of all, of course, thank you. Those of you in the audience here tonight and those listening for 100 episodes at home over the last 3 years. And, of course, to our fantastic patrons. Without you, we would not have been encouraged to go much past episode 2.
And so, I will say, before we finish, I would like to personally thank Nate for doing such an amazing job with this. He's worked extremely hard, as he does with every single show.
Thank you.
It literally wouldn't exist without him. He is a driving force. He's amazing. And he's the most motivated man I know. And I love him for it.
Oh, thank you, buddy. That's not on him.
No, I don't.
Well, it's gone off script.
Oh, no.
It's gone rogue.
Well, from me, Nate Langson.
And me, Ian Morris.
Thank you and good night.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Hope you enjoyed that, everybody. As I said at the start of the show, if you do want to watch this again in video form, you can do. Go to live.techpodcast.uk. You can see the whole thing on YouTube. You can download a copy. It's really a lot of fun to see it live. And also, I think before we wrap up, let's just check in quickly with Tom Merritt from Daily Tech News Show, just to see what we've been missing for the last few days in the global world of tech.
Thanks, guys. This week on Daily Tech News Show, we talked with Ashley Esqueda about Facebook's responsibilities as a publisher, talked with Patrick Beja about whether Europe is the new Silicon Valley, dug into Microsoft's new Game Pass feature for Xbox One, got an Egyptian's take on Egypt's new social media laws, and Andy Beach told us how he's making a game emulation machine with a Raspberry Pi. All that and more right this second at DailyTechNewsShow.com. Back to you.
Thanks, Tom. And see you guys next week for a regular episode. And don't forget, live.techpodcast.uk if you want to watch this week's episode in video form. See you in a week.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.